from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on the Forum program this morning, as part of our ongoing First Person series, we meet Reverend Philip Cousin, who calls himself a child of parsonage and who presently is spiritual leader of the oldest African-American church in San Francisco. One of five brothers, who are all ordained and the son of a Methodist bishop, Reverend Cousin and his family have long been involved in the civil rights struggle. And we'll talk with him about ongoing racial issues and the social activism work of the church. Join us for Forum. It's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Bethel African Methodist Episcopal, otherwise known as AME, a church, is the largest and oldest African-American church in San Francisco. It was founded in 1852, and it plays an integral role in the community with its own credit union, a shelter for homeless women, and an affordable housing complex. The church's leader, Reverend Philip Cousin, increasingly finds himself addressing hate crimes and race issues from the pulpit, especially in the wake of the Charleston church shooting in June. And he joins us for this First Person series of ours, which highlights the leaders and innovators who make the Bay Area unique. And, Pastor, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Krasny. It's my pleasure to be here. I'm honored to have been invited.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. And I guess let's talk a little bit initially about your pedigree, because you call yourself a child of parsonage. You say you're a creature of the church. I mean, go back a number of generations, both you and your wife, and many in your family have been ordained.
Yes, I am a third-generation AME clergyman. My wife is fourth-generation AME preacher's kid. I am the oldest of five sons, all ordained in the African Methodist Episcopal Church and all actively serving. My father is a retired bishop of the denomination. My grandfather was pastor and presiding elder in the denomination. So we have been involved in the church all of our lives. It is all that we know.
And it's a kind of itinerant ministry. You were in North Carolina for a number of years, but the bishop said, go to San Francisco. You come here, and you've been welcome here, and certainly I know delighted to be here. We're delighted to have you here. It's been a couple of years now. Let's talk a bit about the church itself, though. Many of our listeners perhaps don't know. I was educated a good deal learning Rosa Parks was a member of the church, for example.
Oh, yes. There are many prominent AMEs. We can go from Rosa Parks right up to the late Sandra Bland was a member of the AME Church. She belonged to DuPage AME Church in Lyle, Illinois. I know her pastor very well, Reverend Jimmy Miller. So we are intimately connected across the entire spectrum of the civil rights struggle, and more recently the atrocities that have been committed against African Americans in this country. People know about the Selma to Montgomery march that was led by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., certainly one of the more prominent Baptist pastors and preachers in our history. But what they do not know is the march originated out of Brown Chapel AME Church in Selma, Alabama, because our churches standing in connection were not as subject to the kind of direct confrontation that churches that stand independently were. So until very recently, with the Charleston atrocity, there have been no tragedies like that in African Methodism in the last 150 years.
I want to talk to you, of course, about those tragedies and about Sandra Bland and Charleston and other things that you've just mentioned. But also, it's not only important, I think, for listeners to realize how tied your church has been to civil rights struggle and how integral it's been, but also the roots of the church itself. I mean, blacks were not permitted to pray in this church at one time, right?
Well, we were actually founded out of Philadelphia, St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church in 1787. Our founder, Richard Allen, and others walked out of the church because they were not allowed to pray, and they had to worship in the balcony. And so it is ironic that it was in what can arguably be called the cradle of freedom in this country, that our church arose out of protest and the freedom to worship as we saw fit when we saw fit.
Protest still is part of the church's paradigm or ongoing sense of itself?
The protest is a part of our paradigm in as much as by protest we represent the voice of the voiceless. We want to be the voice of the disenfranchised. Those who feel they have no place have a place with us. The church has a very unique history in that regard. When I look at Mother Emanuel in Charleston, Mother Emanuel was founded in 1816 by Morris Brown in what was very much a slaveholding state. But what is unknown is that when the church was founded, they had as many or more white members as they did people of color in 1816.
Let's talk about where we are now. I want to talk about the church's work because it's very important for people to realize. About 355 of the units that are in the Western Addition are owned by your church. Bethel Church has been a minority provider of affordable housing and continues to be, as well as being a place for homeless women and men. And I want to find out the work you're doing. It's important work. And let's talk first about what's so important about what we believe is so important here, having a conversation about race. You feel things are getting worse?
I feel that things are getting worse, yes. And it is interesting how lines have been blurred, because I believe at the end of the day, all of the lines of race can be condensed to lines of economics, lines of demographics. At the end of the day, the issue is color, but the color is not black or white. The color is green.
And in terms of housing, you particularly see that in San Francisco.
With where the church is, I call it an oxymoronic notion: affordable housing in San Francisco. That it was started, though, out of Bethel by one of my predecessors, and I give all of the credit to the late J. Austell Hall, who saw the exodus of African Americans out of the city for largely economic reasons, and determined that the church needed to place itself in the affordable housing arena. And certainly that was something that model was improved upon by my immediate predecessor, the Reverend Dr. Edgar J. Boyd, who now pastors our church in Los Angeles, First AME Church.
We're still seeing black flight, are we not?
Because the economy is still getting worse.
Well, when you talk about things being worse, your emphasis is on the economy. But what about in general in terms of racial relations and racial violence? I mean, what took so many people by surprise and horror was what happened in Charleston, or more recently you mentioned Sandra Bland. These kinds of incidents stand out in people's minds, young men being shot by police officers, of course, now police officers being shot by young men of color, and so it goes back and forth. Are we in a dynamic here where we see things more violent and more volatile than they've ever been, too, with race?
No, the unfortunate reality in this country is that race is still the unaddressed problem in this country. And race relations becomes the topic that no one wants to discuss, that seriously needs to be addressed. I look upon these moments of violence as being Emmett Till moments. And it unfortunately, there seems to be a different Emmett Till moment every day, every week, every month.
I wonder if some of our younger listeners know who Emmett Till even is.
Emmett Till was a young man who was lynched because he wolf whistled at a white woman.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Yeah, I'm not even sure that from some of the accounts he actually did. And we're a year from Ferguson. I mean, and now Darren Wilson, the police officer who was involved in the killing of Michael Brown, is speaking out in ways that are really getting a lot of attention, a lot of highlighting and so forth. But you know, there were those who thought, remember, with a black man elected president, Barack Obama, things would really shift and take a kind of quantum shift. We were in a post-racial society. What you're saying is, go back to W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, the problem of the 20th century was the problem of the color line. It's still the problem?
It's very much still the problem. It is ironic and not entirely accidental that it was with the election of a president of color that suddenly all of these issues, these kinds of conflicts, the kinds of terror that the black community has been subjected to come to increase. I think that if someone did the research, they would discover that this president has been subject to more death threats than all of the presidents in the history of this country combined. That's something that the press does not address.
Also something that you've brought to public attention and certainly to your parishioners and that the press doesn't address, and that is the serious underreporting of crimes against women of color.
Yes, and because you can see it in the way that the media addresses issues. Right now, there has been more media attention focusing on Cecil the Lion than there's been on Sandra Bland.
Yeah, I actually said words to that effect, and some people were not happy with me for saying that, not Sandra Bland, but other stories.
It's just a true observation.
And how does faith sustain you, or for that matter, your flock, if I can refer to the parishioners in that way, in terms of just these kinds of day-to-day struggles and looking at the news, which is sometimes pretty grim?
Well, faith is a function of patience and vigilance. It may not happen when we want it to happen, but we do believe that God still moves in our time, and we have to be patient with that and remain vigilant. We cannot afford to fall asleep. And unfortunately, we have allowed generations to forget. There are generations of children, young people in the African-American community who I guess don't see any distinction much between the Civil War and the Vietnam War. For them, it's all ancient history. The president, I believe today, will be celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. And so it all recedes into what becomes ancient history for our young people. But for me, it's very much a part of my contemporary history. And so we have not done enough to keep our young people informed and educated so that many of them believe that there is no struggle, the struggle is over. No, the struggle continues, very much continues.
Again, if you've just joined us, we are talking to Philip Cousin, Jr. He's pastor with the Bethel AME Church in San Francisco. It is the oldest African-American church in the city. And let me go back to faith for just a moment. Because in the wake of the horror of Charleston, the nightmare of Charleston, I'm talking about a young man who had been praying with people in the church and then wound up shooting a young white man, shooting black people in the church. There were a lot of people who said, we forgive him. And, you know, some of us hear that kind of response and we're kind of in awe but also mystified by it. How can you forgive somebody who takes the lives of your loved ones like that?
Well, in the church and in faith in general, it is universally understood that unless you can forgive, you cannot be forgiven. And so forgiveness has to play a very prominent role in a faithful response. This young man did not act in a void. The church was not chosen at random. Mother Emmanuel's, the oldest African-American church in Charleston. He then is symptomatic of a deeper sickness. And we have to forgive him because we have to forgive the fact that he succumbed to forces that were pushing him, that were promoting these ideas in him. It is alleged that he declared before he began shooting, I do not want to do this, but I have to. Well, based upon what? Based upon some inculcation, some sick notions he received from someone else somewhere.
Where does his own moral free will come into the picture, though? I mean, his decision was his to do what he did.
And if you take seriously some of his postings, that what he wanted to do was to start a race war. He wanted to be a catalyst in some bizarre and sick way. And
so did Charles Manson, and they both deserve to be punished for this crazy notion and for fomenting this kind of thing, right?
Yes.
Why should they be allowed forgiveness? Why should they be permitted to be forgiven?
Well, Charles Manson, I cannot speak to as clear as I can speak to.
I understand. Just making an analogy
to this. Yes, to this young man, and we forgive him for the same reason that that certainly in Christendom that Jesus forgave those who ultimately persecuted and killed him, because he said, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." We forgive this young man because he really didn't know it. 21 years old. You know, he's so green, if you cut him and stuck him in the ground, he'd grow. He had not been living long enough, exposed to enough to really come to himself.
You got a lot of young men who come out of that same world who would not have chosen to do what he did, though, by any stretch. Right?
And the tragedy is that there's even one who can be persuaded or compelled to commit that kind of a horrendous act.
Your church, in terms of what you stand for, you've talked about the dispossessed, the disenfranchised. This is without regard to color, isn't it?
Absolutely without regard to color. When the church was founded, before it was founded, Richard Allen in Philadelphia established what was known as the Free African Society. And during a great influenza epidemic in Philadelphia, it was the members of that Free African Society that served to offer medical services and aid to citizens throughout the city of Philadelphia. Our call has always been to help those in need without regard as to race, creed, or color. We call ourselves AME because it allows us to stay connected to our identity. We are African by our heritage. We are Methodist by our polity. We are Episcopal by our form of government. That accounts for our name.
And those who are provided housing, affordable housing, for example, in the Western Addition, they're not necessarily – this is subsidized housing. You don't have to be a member of this church to get this housing.
That is absolutely the truth. As a matter of fact, very few of the members of the church are in our housing program. I would say we have less than 20% African-American in our housing program.
Now, you may recall, of course, when the Supreme Court decision came across, and even before that, and the last presidential elections. In fact, we went out and did some outreach into the Bayview, and we talked to a lot of citizens there. And there were many, you know, what I would call good folk, you know, good, what you would call your own God-fearing parishioners and so forth, who were adamantly opposed to same-sex marriage. They thought it was sin. I'm sure you've seen this in your congregation, haven't you?
Yes, I have. And I think that this is going to be a real watershed moment for the church and an opportunity for us to do some things to realign and revisit certain theological tenets. The injunctions against homosexuality originate out of the book of Leviticus. But if I followed the Levitical statutes, then it would mean I would no longer eat shellfish. I would have to take off the suit I'm wearing because that's made of wool.
You would not suffer a witch to live.
Yes.
That's right out of Leviticus.
Yes. And what we have done in the church that is an injustice to people in this country is put forth the notion that somehow God grades sin on a curve. And so if I can isolate and identify something that is abhorrent and reprehensible to me that someone else does, a practice in which someone else engages, and distance myself from that by making them an example, I somehow make myself seem better. But no, sin is sin across the board. And what I believe
is sodomy sin.
Well, I think
or that, what was called sodomy.
It is called sodomy, and I believe that's God's business. And so,
not ours as human beings.
As a person of faith, there comes a place where I have to draw the line and allow God to be God, and I have to do what in the New Testament is called work out my own soul salvation in fear and trembling. Or as Jesus also so aptly put it, I believe in Matthew, and I cannot be so concerned with the mote in my brother's eye that I miss the beam in my own.
What do you say to those who are critical of religion who feel that they may give a certain concession to faith, helping people through life as it does undeniably, but that it's caused too many problems? This would be a good example of it. You know, going by the biblical scripture, you're supposed to be throwing stones at the sinner, and the sinner is those who are, for example, having same-sex unions or anything along those lines. And there are those who take a much broader argument and say, this is a problem of organized religion. You've been affiliated with it your whole life. I mean, you grew up in it and so forth. And you know that people indict it.
Well, and the problem with those who level those kinds of indictments at organized religion is that they are looking at it from the outside as opposed to looking at it from the inside, because from the inside they would also know that Jesus said, you know, let the one who is without sin cast the first stone. And what we want the world to see, if I put it in the words of another preacher, not an AME preacher, but E. Dewey Smith, who pastors the House of Hope, said that our call and calling is to evangelize and not antagonize. And so what we want to do is to seek to evangelize and embrace everyone in the world. There was a little
love humanity.
Yes, there's a little bumper sticker theology which says, we are called to be fishers of men. Catch them. It is God's task to clean them.
And where does evil fit in all that?
Evil, the problem of evil for me is resolved in the very way that the study has been done through centuries. The problem of evil in the world falls into the theological realm of theodicy. That is the study of evil. And even that word theodicy is a Greek compound. It is theos dikaios, which means the righteousness of God. So it is impossible to even entertain the notion of evil in the world without first recognizing and acknowledging the righteousness of God. And the problem of evil, I resolve.
Hold that thought, because right. I'm fascinated to hear what you have to say. Philip Cousin Jr. with us, pastor of Bethel AME Church, and having a rich conversation here about race, about same-sex unions, about theology. And by the way, you are welcome to join this conversation, and our toll-free number is yours. It's available now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, please feel free to join the program, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. If you have questions or comments or would like to bring your own voice in, you can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and we'll continue on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with the pastor of San Francisco's oldest black church, reflecting on religion and race and all kinds of other things as well. Bethel African Methodist Episcopal is the largest and oldest African-American church in San Francisco. It was founded in 1852 and continues to play an integral role in the community with its own credit union, a shelter for homeless women, and an affordable housing complex. And the church's leader, Reverend Philip Cousin, is with us this hour as part of our First Person series, which highlights leaders and innovators who make the Bay Area unique. Having certainly a wide-ranging discussion with the Reverend and also talking about, we will talk a little bit more about housing and about the credit union. And I should mention that they not only have a homeless shelter for women, they provide groceries to about, that is the church does, to about 500 to 600 families a week, doing a lot of, I guess, what you call God's work, Reverend. But let's talk about, you mentioned theodicy, and we were talking about Evo touching on, you know, a very radioactive topic, to be sure. But you started to say, and you caught my attention, the way you've sort of come to grips with it?
Well, the way I come to grips with it is in a reading of one very peculiar verse of Scripture found in the New Testament in the letter of Paul to the church at Rome. In Romans chapter 8, verse 28 says, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, who are the called according to his purpose." So now if that is true, then there is even a place for the evil and the injustice that befalls us in this life. And I can, it helps me to set in perspective what happened in Charleston at Mother Emanuel.
Is this what Reverend King talked about as a trajectory moving toward goodness or moving toward a morality in a sense?
Yes, and unfortunately, it is not on our time. It is operating in God's time, but we have to believe that in the end, good will win.
We have to believe?
We have to believe it.
Or we must believe?
We must believe it.
All right. We'll bring our listeners into this. Could you just say something, though, about some of this extraordinary work the church is doing? I mean, you've had a credit union that's over 40 years old. As I said, there are distribution of groceries, there's public housing, there's shelter for women. It's a lot.
And all of this Bethel was doing before I got there. And so I give all of the credit to my predecessors. The homeless shelter houses 35 women 7 days a week and feeds them dinner in the evening, breakfast in the morning. We have partnered with the Provident Foundation, which does that in many churches throughout the city. And the only unfortunate downside of it is that the creation of this shelter has simply illuminated the need for 100 more just like it. I would like to see us in the church look at an area that does not seem to have been addressed as it could be. And I call it transitional housing. There has to be a way for us to transition people from homelessness off of the streets. And I'll be looking for anyone who can partner with us to do that.
Well, that's a vision you have for the future.
Yes.
Okay. Let's bring our callers into this, and we'll begin with Barbara. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question for the pastor. And I was wondering, what is your take on the rift that's growing between the NAACP and the Black Lives Matter movement? One is hip and cool, the other is staid and true, and I belong to the NAACP. I am a white woman, but I'm disheartened by that. And the second question, if you have time, is I'd like to know what your stance is on separation of church and state.
Well, to the thank you for those questions. We appreciate them, Barbara. This is the first question first. Is there a lot of contention going on between the NAACP and Black Lives Matter? I'm not aware.
That would be a generational conflict, the same kind of general conflict that occurred between the movement of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And SNCC.
And Malcolm X.
Malcolm X and the Panthers. Looking at trying to reach the same end by radically different means. The Black Lives Matter movement, it has certainly been fueled. I don't want to use the word inspired, but been fueled by all of these recent attacks against Black lives. I've seen a retort that says all lives matter. And yes, all lives do matter. However, it is Black lives now that are under fire. And so I can hold to the tenet that all lives matter. But for me right now, Black lives matter because Black lives are the ones at risk. Black lives are the ones in jeopardy.
We should mention that SNCC was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee headed by Stokely Carmichael. And Barbara, what was your second question? I'm sorry.
Church and state.
Well,
church and state. Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because we should mention just for the record here that the Reverend had experiences in public life. I mean, he's from North Carolina, originally served on the school board there for 10 years and 4 years. As county commissioner for 10 years and then on the school board for 4 years. So did you ever get any of that kind of sense of people saying, well, come on, you're in a secular world here of public government. Does that cross over to your church duties and so forth? Well, Reverend Brown got it, I think, when he was supervisor here in San Francisco, Amos Brown.
I believe that the state has a different notion of what separation is from what the church has. For me, I cannot see a real separation, a real line of demarcation, because in the public sector, when I served in the public sector, I was serving the entire community of faith, because that I'm looking for wholeness and not any kind of differentiation between things sacred and things secular, realm sacred, realm secular. For me, it is all sacred. When I serve all of the people, and that is all of the people of God. The separation of church and state was ironically put into place as much to preserve religious freedom and defend it as to differentiate from it. And so I am not as concerned from my vantage point as I am about the state infringing upon the rights of the church. Every now and then, for instance, the church has to fend off the attacks of those who say that we should be taxed as an institution. And so I have to keep an eye on that.
What's your argument against that? There are many people who do believe that it should be taxed.
Well, if we from our current status, and if you look at what the church has done historically, the church was the place where people went to receive help before there was any government assistance. And government there's an ebb and tide of governmental assistance, and the church always stands there, ready to fill in those times when by the politics of the country. You've got a drawing away from, a pulling back from public assistance. We see it even in the city of San Francisco in the way that the city appears to be divesting itself of affordable housing and giving this over to nonprofits and to religious communities.
But you know, for example, we were talking in the last hour about John Stewart, and he's been criticized for not bringing up Scientology with Tom Cruise. The Church of Scientology called itself a church and became tax-free as a result. And, you know, there are people who say you can almost call anything a church in this sense of division between churches, not getting taxed.
And that is where the problem comes in. Because when we look at what we have to differentiate in a church is what are the hallmarks of a religious nonprofit as opposed to a community of faith. A church is a community of faith. A synagogue is a community of faith. And synagogue is a very interesting word. You know, synagogue is a Greek word. It's sun agoge. It means a gathering together. And that's an aside. It is a community of faith as opposed to a
Scientologists faith-based. Say they're a community of faith.
I see them as a faith-based organization.
Okay. Has your preaching changed since you've come to San Francisco?
Since I've come to San Francisco, my preaching has caused me to focus more on inclusion and the open invitation of the gospel, which is whosoever will, let them come. I have become more aware as I left the Bible Belt, actually the very buckle of the Bible Belt, and moved to San Francisco, of just what the church has done historically to the homosexual same-sex marriage community is akin to what was done to African Americans during slavery.
Let's bring some more of our callers into the discussion here, and we go to Point Richmond. And Robert, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to ask the pastor that I see when I'm driving around, or even I've even visited, I see United Methodist Church, and I also see the AME Church. How do they differ?
Well, that's that. Thank you for asking that question. We differ in only by our government. The United Methodist Church is a different denomination, but we are all Methodists. We broke away from what became the United Methodist Church. When we broke away from St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church as far back as 1787, but it was the founders of the Methodist Church from the Anglican Church who ordained our first bishop, Richard Allen. So the only differences are in the fact that we are separate denominations. We have the same form of government. The United Methodists have bishops. We have bishops. We operate in the same way, and we have far more in common than we have at variance.
And we thank you for the question, and we go to another caller from San Jose, Verinia. Excuse me. You're on.
I want to address the issue that the pastor spoke about concerning homosexuality. First of all, it's not a sin to world rule. It's a sin to world rule and together. Also, the Apostle Paul talks about homosexuality and says that no homosexual shall inherit the kingdom of God. So I don't think this is just a Levitical concept.
All right, and so if we're going to take into account everything that Paul says, go to the letter to the Romans and look in the first chapter at the litany of sin that is mentioned there. And in there you will find those who are disrespecters of parents, backbiters, whisperers, inventors of evil things. And what the only point I am making is that we do not need to lift and somehow set apart some sin and not recognize all sin.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of your emails here and online comments. Paul writes, I worked for some time in emergency services, and I was struck by how frequently blacks treated law enforcement officers in a provocative and insulting fashion. And I still find this phenomenon ironic and sad, given how blacks demand that they be treated respectfully. I would be interested in the Reverend's thoughts on this matter.
Well, here is the irony. We, unfortunately, as people of color in this country, have been conditioned to be distrustful of law enforcement. I am a 59-year-old African-American male, and I still get nervous whenever I look into my rearview mirror and see a police car. I know that we are twice as likely to be stopped for DWB, which is driving while black. I can be dressed in a suit as I am now, but I am twice as likely to be profiled and followed in a department store, in any kind of business into which I go. And these are the kinds of circumstances that we unfortunately have had to live with. I am the father of three sons, and I have had to make certain that I tell them how to behave, what to do and what not to do if they are ever stopped by the police.
Was it worse in North Carolina, though, in your mind, than it is, say, up here in the Bay Area?
I think it is a matter of perspective. And unfortunately, we find that it occurs throughout this country. So in that sense, it is endemic. And it should not be lost that far before Sandra Bland became belligerent, she was stopped because she failed to signal changing lanes. And what she was doing, ironically, was getting out of the way of a police car.
Do you think it was a suicide? What does your gut tell you?
My gut tells me that there was nothing suicidal about that. If you look at some of her posts on Facebook and listen to her family, No. And then finding marijuana in her system 3 days after she'd been in jail. I'm not a physician, but I'm pretty certain that marijuana does not stay in one system for 72 hours.
I have a listener, Colleen, who writes, "To forgive a person does not condone their action." Thank you, Colleen. And Michael from Albany writes, "Regarding poverty in America, the philosopher Peter Singer observes that the poor in America are wealthy by world standards. Can the poor in America live better lives now based on the resources and talents they or we now possess? And should the American poor contribute money to help the truly poor by world standards?" It's an interesting perspective to think of.
It's a very interesting perspective, yeah. And I'm familiar with some of the philosophy of Peter Singer. Unfortunately, it goes back about 40 years.
Well, we've had him on more recently than that, although sometimes it seems like he may have been on with us during the early days of this program over 20 years ago, but he's been on more recently as well. What about that idea, though, about the poor having a responsibility to those who are more poor than they are, let's say?
Well, I would not lift and isolate the poor in that notion. I think that everyone would have a responsibility to reach down and to help the least.
Christine writes, "Tech companies have recently been called to task regarding their appalling low hiring rates of African Americans. I wonder if Reverend Cousins' green racism," I love that frame, by the way, "includes the racial consequences of tech-based gentrification."
And unfortunately, it would have to. I think that if an examination were made of those tech companies, we would find that there's an alarming lack of a presence of people of color on their boards of directors, as well as in the front offices and in those who are providing the services. And those are issues that have to be addressed.
And again, we welcome your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Here's Roger. Roger, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Michael. Reverend Cousins, it's a pleasure listening to what you say. You show a great deal of compassion and understanding. I wish all religious leaders had the same insights. I'd like to talk a moment just about evil. I think if you can't forgive an evil act, you tie yourself to that act. If you can't forgive a person, no matter what he does, you're tied to that person. By forgiving, you relieve your soul. You relieve your mind from that position. And one thing about will. I am Catholic. I know something about will. But I think a will can be molded. You only have to look back into the 30s in Germany and how they molded that whole population into thinking a certain way. I wish we truly had free will. But I'm afraid sometimes we don't. And Michael, thank you for this opportunity, and thank you, Reverend Cousins. You're a treasure to this area.
Thank you, Roger, for the call. So you want to reflect a bit about your connection now to this area? It's been 2 years, and like you say, you came out of the Bible Belt. You're in a different universe here. Does it feel like home now?
I really do, because what it has been my pleasure to discover is people really are the same from sea to shining sea. I have found to be as large and diverse a city as San Francisco is, it certainly has some of the friendliest people. I think that they have the most altruistic of motivations, and I can see where people really are working to a common good.
But many are not God-fearing or God-loving, and they're still working for that common good. Does that bother you?
That's my job. I'll get them to the God-loving part.
You're going to bring them in the church. All these stone-cold atheists, good luck with that. There's also a sense you've described about how beautiful San Francisco is. Can you say something about that? I don't want to go into chauvinism about San Francisco, but you've said this publicly.
There have been occasions, particularly when I first got here, you turn a corner and you run into a vista that is so drop-dead gorgeous until it makes you forget for a moment whatever was bothering you. And so I've appreciated that. This affords me a wonderful opportunity, because there was much left in Bethel Church on which I can build. And so I am extremely optimistic and very enthusiastic about what the future holds.
And boy, do you want to build. I mean, transitional housing and additional housing and on and on.
I want to see, I'd like to see us become a larger player, contributor in the realm of affordable housing. I would also like to see us establish transitional housing. I believe that we should be able to establish housing that would transition people from the streets into affordable housing. The problem with the affordable housing model has been with ancillary services. It is one thing to provide housing, but we need to look at educational services, at job-creating services, at the kinds of services that sustain and also would allow people to aspire to move out of affordable housing into permanent home ownership.
Do you know Raphael House? Have you met?
No, no, I don't.
Well, they're in San Francisco. They people you may want to partner with, done some extraordinary work because they offer a place for families, for homeless families, temporarily. But the idea is to school them and to prepare them to move into, well, whatever they can move into, you know, in terms of being self-sufficient.
That is exactly what I would like to see. And I realize that this is in no way an original idea. It is just something that I believe needs to be done on a massive scale. If we could put people into transitional housing and challenge them to rise up out of it by shifting the paradigm of what affordable housing is in San Francisco, allowing people to set aside a large portion of their income to the goal of transitioning out, at the same time teaching them financial responsibility, helping them with job acquisition skills. That's what I would like to see. I can get excited talking about that.
Yeah, I can hear. We're talking to Pastor Philip Cousin Jr., and he is pastor of Bethel AME Church in San Francisco, the oldest African-American church in the city of San Francisco. And here's Thomas. Thomas, welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, Michael. This is definitely one of your best shows, by the way, Michael. And the AME Church is, I think, the foremost church in the probably in the world, too, in terms of setting a true biblical example and living the true life of Jesus Christ on earth. But the problem is our military is as segregated as our pre-World War II military was, in terms of combat brigades and the service part of the military, with all the women and minorities being in service, in the kitchen, so to speak, and combat units being almost exclusively white. In fact, there's a massive infiltration of neo-Nazis. Colonel Finkel, I think Finkelstein, was doing an investigation in Washington. In just 2 weeks, he uncovered almost 200 neo-Nazis, and he was so successful that he was called off the job. In other words, he was going to ruin our entire combat capability.
You know, Thomas, this is total news in many ways. So I'm going to have to do some research on this because, if anything, the military, especially from the standpoint of before World War II, has come a pretty extraordinary way in terms of, well, in fact, it's one of the few places, so the argument goes, that has seen real integration. Pastor, can you shed any light on this?
I would like to see some more investigation done on that as well. I find it, if it is true, that is certainly alarming. But
news to me. And if you have anything to send us to look at, Thomas,
I would love it. I would love to be a part of getting to the bottom of that.
Thank you for the call. Here's a listener who says, this is Hollis. I mean this sincere. This question is not smart alecky. Would your guest weigh in on medical or medicinal marijuana? Is it a sin? You never know what you're going to get thrown
really
at. That's
don't.
The beauty of live radio, yeah.
There is, if I can remember where the question so throws me, I forget where it is, but there is in the Acts of the Apostles, there is a wonderful story of Peter going to sleep and in a dream being told by God not to call anything that I have made unclean. And so when I look at the medicinal value of marijuana, I mean, well, I'm living in a world where people can take bread mold and cure syphilis. So I don't know how to exactly weigh in on that, But I come down in favor of the medicinal side as opposed to the recreational side of marijuana, and that's where the real argument begins.
Would you not? Would you use the word sin, though, for recreational use of marijuana? I think that's maybe what.
All right. No. I would not use the word. I would not use the word sin for that. In fact, in the Bible, as it pertains to indulgence, the only sin is overindulgence. People in some faith branches look upon drinking as being a sin. No, drinking is only a sin when the drink takes the person. Taking the drink is not the sin. It is allowing the drink to take you. And so I draw a pretty liberal line. That I know that medicinal marijuana helps people who are in excruciating pain who otherwise could not have that pain addressed. And so I would certainly not want to forbid them from having that relief.
Let me just read a couple of quick emails before we conclude. Leona says, thank you for having this gentleman on your show today. Painful subjects that need to be discussed. Another listener writes, the Reverend's comments on affordable housing ring true. We have all this building and construction happening in San Francisco. They are building residential units for the most part. But who will be able to afford to live in these units? For whom are these units being built? And Trey says, love this program. As a long-term supporter and advocate for the rights of all minority communities, I'm frustrated and heartbroken by the continual assault on black and brown bodies by law enforcement officials and the deeply ingrained racism inherent in America's mass incarceration of young men and the school-to-prisons pipeline. Other than advocacy, voting, and donating, middle-aged white gay male, what can he do to support the rights of the African-American community? Quickly, if you could.
I'm at 916 Laguna Street every Sunday morning at 8 and 11.
There you
have
it.
You can come and be a part of us, and we would love to have you.
And thank you so much. Love to have you on. Appreciate you.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed my time immensely.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.